Hi everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, and welcome back from a long break. It's season 4, episode 1 of the podcast. Today's guest is Mike Bergen. Mike is a nationally recognized leader in education. Mike founded Chariot Learning in 2009 to deliver on the promise of what truly transformative individualized education can and should be. Besides overseeing Chariot Learning's national programs, Mike is an ACT certified educator who trains teachers across the country to implement critical skills and college and career readiness standards. Mike is also the founding president of the board of directors of the National Test Prep Association. Mike is also the creator of SAT-ACT Test Flip Program. And lastly, Mike is the co-author of the Amazon bestseller Crash and Learn, Lessons in Business. I had a great chat with Mike, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Hey everyone, buckle up for a new episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, the one and only podcast made to help you launch your business or take your existing business to a level of success you could never have imagined. Whether you're a school owner, freelancer, publisher, or other entrepreneur, you're sure to pick up lots of actionable advice when you listen to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Remember to visit EFLmagazine.com for great articles and features. Without further ado, here's your host, the founder of EFL Magazine, Philip Pound.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. And it's my great delight, pleasure to have Mike Bergen. And Mike is an educational entrepreneur. And Mike, please take it away, your other job titles and how you like to be referred to.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for having me on the show. Yeah, I like to call myself an educational entrepreneur because I wear a lot of hats in the field where education and business intersect. I'm the president of Chariot Learning, which is an American SAT-ACT preparatory organization. I am the co-host of the Test and the Rest podcast. I'm the founding president of the board of directors of the National Test Prep Association. I am the editor of Tutor the newsletter. I get involved in all kinds of projects that have to do with bringing educators together or serving students.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that, Mike. And I want to talk a little bit about where you are today, because you said you're in upstate New York. Now, as I said to you before the podcast, I don't know too much about New York, but I know Washington Irving, the Catskill Mountains.
Oh, sure.
That sort of area. Yeah.
Philip, it's so funny that you say that, right? Because so I'm from downstate New York. I'm from New York City, which is where everybody envisions when they think of New York State. So I'm from the Bronx. And when I grew up, we considered Sleepy Hollow, which is where Washington Irving's legend comes from, as upstate New York. But Sleepy Hollow is really still part of the greater New York City area. You have to travel pretty far north. New York State is actually a very large state. And I live in Rochester, New York right now, which is over 350 miles away from New York City. And I'm actually closer to Toronto than I am to any major U.S. city.
Okay, so that's told me. So tell me a little bit about growing up in the Bronx. I remember there was a TV show. I don't know if we're around the same age, Mike. Maybe you're a lot younger than me. But there's a TV show called The Bronx Zoo,
Of course. Well, interestingly, so The Bronx Zoo was based on Kennedy High School, which was right down the block from my apartment building.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up in North. I believe Ed Asner was the.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So growing up in New York for me was fantastic. I wanted to tell you this, Philip, because, you know, the part of New York where I grew up, it was such a melting pot. So, you know, you had Irish culture, Italian culture, Jewish culture, Black culture, Puerto Rican culture. And it was just, you know, Russian culture. It's just a great mix. Lots of fantastic food and access to anything that you wanted to go experience if you could stand the transportation. if you can stand the bus or the subway or whatever else it took to get around. But growing up in New York, those days were was really fantastic.
But wasn't it in around that time in the early 80s that the crime problem was huge, wasn't it, in New York? And suddenly, I think things got better. Was it Rudy Giuliani and zero tolerance?
Rudy Giuliani was not. Okay. There were a lot of demographic reasons why crime changed. But I think that many of us experience this throughout the world where you hear about crime in a certain city, but crime is usually restricted to, in urban areas, specific blocks. You know, I live in Rochester. I've been in Rochester, New York for 14 years. And when I moved here, Rochester was like the murder capital of New York State. But sadly, I mean, it's sadly that there are any violent crimes, but usually it's just very small areas that the crime is restricted. We're just, you know, people who are struggling and having really hard lives are shooting each other. And it's sad. It doesn't really impact a lot of people who live. You look at the per capita crime rate and you'd think that in so many cities in the world, you would be unsafe. But in fact, you're usually very safe, aside maybe from pickpockets or scams and things like that.
Mm. Yeah, it reminds me of the Charles Bronson movies.
Right.
As you'd say in America, homage, isn't it? The movie Joker is kind of a homage to the Charles Bronson movies in some ways. Isn't
exactly.
It?
Or the old, Dirty Harry, Make My Day.
Exactly. Yeah.
But really, New York has always been an amazing place to live and visit. The great cities of the world, the biggest challenge living there is the high cost of living and how long it takes to get anywhere. I believe Tokyo has a lot of those challenges where it has a fantastic train system, but things are very far apart.
That's true, but it's very efficient. It's on time. It's clean. It's safe. Which I think I watched a YouTube video. They made a comparison between the New York transportation system and Tokyo. I think the difference is investment and costs. So the price of a train ticket here is relatively expensive. Is relatively more expensive than in New York. I mean, you even look at like the ticket gates, they say in New York, you still got the kind of
the turnstiles, yes. But we have the Metro cards, right? We don't, I think maybe they've moved to an app in some places, but not any time earlier than Japan or other Asian countries did. Basically the difference between the New York City subway system and say the Tokyo system is the difference between a 19th century system and a 21st century system. They're massively different in terms of efficiency.
That's true. Yeah, I think the first rail line in Tokyo, or the first metro line, subway line, underground line, whatever you want to call it, was, you're testing me out now. It's maybe 1919, I think.
Yeah.
It was from, where was it? It was from Ginza. No, it wasn't. Asakusa, I think. Yeah. So, yeah, in New York, it was, 1880s, I'm guessing?
It was, and I think some of the original tracks are still there. It's just, all of New York City seems to be supported by ancient infrastructure. And they have to pump it constantly. If the pumps ever stop working, New York City will be underwater.
Mm. And what is the steam we always see in New York in the movies, especially in Taxi Driver? Mark Scorsese used it to great effect. What's going on there?
I'm not going to hazard a guess as to what that is. Just don't walk through it.
Yeah, it may not be steam. That's all we can say about that. So, yeah, growing up in New York, exciting, cosmopolitan place. And from anybody from New York, they love it. They want to go back there. They say how great the people are in New York as well, mm-hmm. contrary to, what we see in media sometimes.
Well, it's funny. And I think that New Yorkers are really great to people who are not from New York City. We have a lot more tolerance for visitors than we do for natives. You'll get the worst of a New Yorker if they recognize you're one of them.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's like what Samuel Johnson said about the Irish, wasn't he? He says they're very fair. They never speak well of one another. So that's that's maybe the same for New Yorkers. Yeah, that's interesting. So you grew up in New York, and then what happened next, Mike? You decided to set sail somewhere, or
yeah, I did. I moved around. I moved around the United States. You know, I'm a New Yorker who loves New York State but hates winter. And unfortunately, it really, like, you can't have one without the other. And I moved to other parts of the country. I moved to Texas. I moved to California a couple of times and tried to fit in, but I kept being pulled back to the Northeast of the United States. And then, you know, at a certain point, I recognized that I did not have the ambition to remain in New York. You really do have to be willing to fight for every parking spot, every opportunity. So I had young children, and my wife and I uprooted, and we moved to upstate New York, way upstate, you know, right here on Lake Ontario. And then this is where I've had my roots for the last 14 years. Not long after I moved to Rochester, I started Chariot Learning, and I had been in the test prep industry for a long time before that. I started with Kaplan, you know, the famous Kaplan Educational Services, and I was a teacher and eventually a manager and then a director for many counties in the New York metro region. And then Huntington Learning Center recruited me at a certain point to help revamp their SAT, ACT programs. And so I was the director of exam prep in the corporate office for nearly a decade. But then, you know, when I arrived in Rochester is where I found my entrepreneurial footing and struck out on my own to really explore a vision of education that was instructor driven. That really, I mean, you know this, Philip, you get the best educational outcomes when you have a talented, experienced tutor and a motivated, eager student. Now put those two ingredients together with time, there's not much you can't accomplish.
Okay. And it's, Well, I'm sure you'll enlighten me, but it's really a time of change for test prep industry, isn't it? I think from what I know, and please fill me in here on my knowledge gaps, which are, you know, cavernous, but it is not so many universities are requiring, for example, SAT tests now in the States. There's obviously been the COVID, the pandemic, where people have had, you know, tests from home. There's been new entrants to the market, for example, Duolingo. Mm-hmm. And our friends, just to give a mention, our friends in ETS, who will be running the second TOEFL conference in October as well. So I'll give the listeners more details as they come on that one. So yeah, could you kind of paint a picture for us, Mike?
Absolutely.
What it's like in the test prep industry at the moment and testing.
So I'll speak specifically to SAT, ACT, which is the biggest part of the test prep industry in the United States, but certainly not the only part. We have a suite of graduate tests. ETS administers the GRE, and there's an MCAT for medical school and an LSAT for law school, a GMAT for business school. There's a host of high school entrance exams, but basically the big tests are the SAT and ACT for college admissions. And the two exams really, you know, in 2019, you basically had roughly 2 million students taking each of those two tests. And then in 2020, COVID hit, and the, you know, some of the things that happened is when the pandemic hit, immediately College Board in the spring of 2020, College Board canceled several test dates. They canceled a May and a June SAT date. ACT canceled an April and a June test date. And schools closed. So what happened was students couldn't test at all. And then going into the summer, it was still extremely difficult to find a location to test. Going into the fall, it became extremely difficult to test. And prior to that period, there were individuals and organizations that had already been pushing to eliminate testing, eliminate that standard, that objective standard in the admissions process. So to summarize everything that happened, we had kind of a wave. There was a period that seemed very dark for anyone who supported objective standards as part of the college admissions process. And, you know, really, the colleges will do what they'll do. Every college determines the criteria by which it wants to evaluate students. It's not my place to tell any admissions office how they should handle college admissions. But as an educator, I look at the fact that during the pandemic, we saw rampant grade inflation, which was already a trend pre-pandemic. We saw that the gap between subjective school-based assessments and objective standardized assessments grew, not to the benefit of student knowledge. And we've seen a real gap, at least in the United States. And you can let me know if this is the case for the higher educational communities that you support. But we've seen the graduation rate declining. That, you know, we used to talk about a four-year graduation rate for universities in the United States. Now they all talk about a six-year graduation rate. And National Student Clearinghouse does this longitudinal study. And just last year, they determined that, you know, the graduation rate in within 6 years is still less than 2/3 of students, which is terrible. So basically, there was a period of time where schools all said, look, we don't need your tests. You couldn't test, or you wouldn't test, or you won't test. And so we don't need your test scores. But now they're back, and the schools that are still saying that they're test optional are test optional for some students, and for other students, the tests are still mandatory. And there's a tension right now where students don't know whether they need to submit scores or not. And the students that do need to submit scores need to submit higher scores than ever. There is a clear, what they call a submitter advantage at many universities, but this circumstance now reminds me of the state of admissions pre-pandemic, when there were still students that could get into colleges with lower standards. The celebrities, the full pays, that hasn't changed. There's still opportunity for people. It's just more difficult for applicants to know what category they fit into. But for everyone else, I still recommend the tests because they're valuable, not just for admissions purposes, not just for scholarship purposes, but more and more I pay attention to this concept of college readiness. So even if I'm talking to a family where I know that the student will not need to submit test scores, their test scores are so low that we would be concerned that they couldn't pass intro to college algebra, English 101, they're very much in peril of not graduating from that school without those fundamental skills. So earn a test score that at least tells you you have a good chance of passing those early classes and getting your footing and making it to your second year.
Okay, I think that's the definitive answer, Mike. I'll move on there. I don't want to get involved in comparative educational systems in different countries. So that's a whole different series of podcasts, I think.
Okay, but, good. We'll hit those another time.
We'll hit those another time. So I want to get back to starting Chariot Learning in Rochester, New York. So you said you found your entrepreneurial feet. Tell me about that.
So it's interesting, and the experience of starting your own company is alien to many people. I did not grow up in a tradition where people started companies, no matter what they were. My family, you know, I grew up, you know, with some economic insecurity and people who, you know, families who appreciated steady jobs, even if they were civil servant jobs. So, you know, from going on to school and holding a host of roles in different organizations, I got a sense of how corporate offices work and how educational organizations functioned. And as I worked my way up from teacher to manager to director, I learned a lot about business and sales and marketing and human resources and curriculum development. And I basically learned all of the different pieces of running an organization. And at a certain point, I said, well, I have all the pieces. I do have all the pieces, and I have a vision, and maybe it's time for me to do this myself. And I know that being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. But for those for whom it is the right fit, you very soon make yourself unemployable. It's, you know, it's at this point, I really feel much more comfortable and I feel more secure starting a company that I know is going to be sound financially. It's going to have a great proposition for clients and be able to do good in a community and build strong word of mouth and be profitable. So that it was an experience, you know, starting a company in a city where I didn't really have a great network. And what I had to rely on at that time was this vision of education that made sense. This idea that, you know, I was really, at that time, I was frustrated with the compromises of retail education. You're used to a certain kind of what we call a big box program. And, you know, not to take anything from those larger operators that have national or international operations, but there again, you know, when it comes to tutoring, when it comes to teaching, there's something about one really skilled educator, one really motivated student, and the path to transformational outcomes. And so I took a bet on it. I thought, you know, I'll try this because I love teaching and I've grown to love the idea of business. I want to see how it works. And if it didn't work, I was just going to leave education entirely. I was going to go do something else because I did start to enjoy business. And now I do. I enjoy business as much as I enjoy education. And I love to be able to make both my twin passions.
And we're glad you didn't. So it was interesting. You said leave education if it didn't work. I think I read some advice recently. I think it was Alex Hormozy. I'll put a link in the show notes. His stuff is great. He has I don't know if I have the book here. I don't. But he's got 100 million offers. But he said in the book that a lot of entrepreneurs who are not successful, what they do is they try maybe 1-2 years and they decide the sector is wrong. The industry is wrong.
Right.
And they leave and they try something else. So you didn't do that.
I didn't do that. No, I mean, I had a pretty good operation set up. It was very lean. I was immediately profitable. I had a vision. Again, you know, I think that part of the entrepreneurial journey is to decide, do you want to create a job for yourself or do you want to create a business, an organization that operates independently of you individually? And I knew that I didn't want to just create a job for myself. The conventional tutor path is you hang out a shingle, so to speak, you promote your name and you try to build a book of business and you just work for yourself. And when you're busy, you put people on a wait list. And when you need clients, you go do some marketing or whatever you need to do. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to create an organization. I wanted to hire teachers. I wanted to build out a curriculum that was similar to the kind of programs that I created for, you know, very large national organization. I thought I could create my own curriculum that would work for the kind of tutoring that we were offering. And so I was able to do all those things. I was able in a year to build up enough of a clientele that I could start hiring tutors and go through all of the agonies and ecstasies of doing that. And we were able to build relationships with schools and libraries and community organizations and put a stamp on the community about, you know, this is something that we could provide. We could offer services, we could offer free resources, we could build out this path and succeed not just in Rochester, but in Syracuse and in Buffalo. No, these are cities around Rochester. That's kind of the upstate New York corridor. But now, you know, Chariot Learning, we work with students around the country. And that just has to do with the growing network and the extension of the vision that I originally had, which is still teacher-based. You have a great teacher, you have a great model, you free someone up. You know, you speak with a lot of educators, Philip. You know that teaching is not just an art, it is a craft. There's a technical aspect to it. And the more you teach, the more, if you are a learner, the way all great teachers are, you're constantly refining your craft and becoming better at it. And the benefits that students accrue from working with teachers, tutors, educators, coaches, whatever you call yourself, yourself in your particular extension of this practice, they benefit from a true professional, not someone who's just doing it on the side. It's not just a side hustle. This is the work that you bring to the world. And then it's just fantastic.
And from the outset, you decided that you weren't going to just exchange hours for money. You're going to make it scalable, and you're going to make an impact.
It's, you know, the latter was more important at the outset. It's still as important, because it's hard to get out of that trap, right, of exchanging just time for money. And at the end of the day, there's still not so much you can do to get away from it in a service business. And, you know, I see a lot test preparation, like every academic service, you know, whatever it is, it's math tutoring, it's teaching English as a foreign language, whatever it is, there's always somebody with a new scalable idea. Oh, we're going to use artificial intelligence. Oh, we're going to commoditize it. At the end of the day, a lot that creates a broad filter, but then people still climb up the value ladder and they eventually find themselves in front of a tutor again who's somehow exchanging time for money.
Yeah, that's my Japanese language learning path. Yeah. So yeah. I could show you the books and the apps, and then you try another app, and then you go back to that app. So, and then you eventually have to go back to the teacher, don't you? That's exactly
right. I mean, but of course, all the different ways to build out that value and impact more individuals. Because when you create an app, when you create a program, when you write, when you podcast, then you can educate people without necessarily having to spend time specifically speaking with them. And that frees you up to then address even deeper challenges, even more intractable problems and complex issues.
Okay, and just we just go back to the beginning a little bit again about Chariot Learning. So when you entered the market, who were already there? How did you differentiate
yourself?
Yeah, that's
the funny thing, Philip.
Yeah.
That's the funny thing, because when I arrived in Rochester again, I was Huntington Learning Center used to have a center in Rochester. They were gone. Kaplan had a center in Rochester. They had pulled up stakes, or they were in the process of leaving. I arrived at a time when, you know, besides some small individual tutors, there was no what we call a boutique tutoring firm. You know, all across the United States, there are these boutique companies. You know, usually the founder is someone, you know, who follows my model. You were a test prep professional, or you made yourself one, and then you built a small practice around, maybe a large practice. And there were no operators like me, and there still aren't, which is just shocking. It's, you know, because it's such a, I landed accidentally, really. And I guess it wasn't accidentally, because I arrived here because I wanted to send my kids to great public schools. And Rochester has many fantastic public schools. And so I found myself in surrounded by communities where families really valued education, which was the perfect place to set up a business like this.
Okay. And the test prep industry in New York, in Rochester, you entered at the right time, and you went for the value of life. Then about expanding. So you've mentioned that a little bit. How do you know? So the question I want to ask is, how do you know when to expand? Or, you know, that here in Japan, for example, there's been some notable failures of businesses. Yeah. For example, Aeon, who've expanded too quickly. And, you know, we've seen in the past, 10, 15, 20 years of, you know, expansion in property markets, et cetera. So how do you know when to, you know, be more conservative, or when to take a leap, or like, what would we say, calculated gamble?
Calculated gamble. The interesting thing is, when you're talking about our industry, we will, for better or for worse, as long as we're focusing on service, the service model, we'll never track the kind of ridiculous venture capital that will cause us to, you know, somehow be $1 billion in the hole and not be able to match our burn rate. We just don't get those kinds of investments. Really, you're talking about individuals that are taking risks. Maybe I'll sign this lease for 2 years on this new center. I will invest in this marketing. It's difficult. I find it really difficult for tutors to get so far ahead of themselves that they imperil themselves financially, and that, you know, you can hire new tutors, but chances are, if the business doesn't match, you lay them off. I know individuals that signed leases literally weeks before the pandemic shut everything down. And, you know, some of those individuals I know are looking to add even more space now. Like they managed to survive. I think we're fortunate in this sector to not expand too quickly. Now, the larger organizations often do. The franchise organizations, I know franchise organizations that oversell and then they retract after lots of painful lawsuits and their mass layoffs. Those aren't the models I'm talking to, because at a certain point, every corporation looks the same. It's just whatever widget they deploy in their retail centers depends. Maybe you sell pet food, maybe you sell tutoring. I'm not speaking about that because in that environment, anybody can get ahead of themselves. But for those of us on the ground, those of us within arm's length, in a proverbial sense of our clients, you really, you know, what I speak to educators that want to expand about is to consider kind of what problems do they most enjoy solving? And what is their adjacent possible? Do you know that term, the adjacent possible?
Please educate me.
So it's you imagine, like, what is it that you do? I teach SAT, ACT preparation. Okay, so if that's my circle, what's adjacent to it? I can do subject tutoring. If you're an SAT, ACT tutor, you do a lot of math tutoring. You can go into that. That's a very easy addition or extension. You can go into, you know, English. You can go into college admissions, right? You can say, all right, I'm already working with families that need this service. This would be an easy upsell, an easy addition. If you're tutoring, you can choose to expand by adding in group instruction. If you are tutoring in person, maybe you can decide to tutor remote. Maybe you can decide to add another center. So you can expand in all different directions. And what I find is that most tutors, most small business owner tutors follow that path. They figure out whichever thing is most interesting to them. They say, okay, I'm going to write a book. Oh, I'm going to create software. I'm going to add another center. I'm going to add another service. And it's a lot of fun to explore all the different places your interest can take you.
Fantastic. And that's a great lesson for anyone who suffers from overwhelm or overreach, you know, the adjacent possible. So tell me about... okay. So the question I was going to ask was about loss aversion. So I think you mentioned a little bit about where to apportion money, budgets, you know, on marketing, certain areas. And I think you're almost saw your face wincing a little bit on that. So tell me, you know, sometimes we loathe to put our efforts or our money in a certain areas because, you know, we're doubtful about the outcome. Of course, it's natural, it's human nature. But so tell me about some experiences of that, some things that have gone well and some things that have not gone so well.
Sure. So here's another part of the process, right? Kind of what you're implying is that if you're in business, you have to spend money to make money. It's absolutely true. You can't, you know, even tutoring, which has a beautiful, if you just look at the margin, the profit margin, which is, you know, your revenues minus your expenses, how much do you take home? All tutoring should be profitable if you are the tutor. And then, you know, even if you're adding other tutors, you can still make it pretty profitable. The scaling can be challenging, but in terms of the individual profit per hour, if you manage your expenses well, it should be great. So, you know, some of the things that people do is they avoid spending in areas they should, like marketing, like operations. They often fail to pursue efficiencies, you know, invest a little bit in a calendar app, or even better, invest in administrative hours to allow you to do more work. There are a lot of areas where all professionals need to be willing to spend, but they also need to make sure that they don't fall for conventional wisdom or solutions that used to make sense. I'll give you an example. When I started, the yellow pages were gone. So, right, like the classic, the phone book, you would take an ad out in a phone book. And that was an entrepreneurial staple, or let's just say a business owner staple, for decades. You could count on, if you could put an ad there, that was it. Okay. Basic things like flyers, you could flyer windshields, that eventually went out of vogue. I experimented with all the different forms of advertising. I experimented with print advertising, advertising in newspapers. I experimented with radio. There was that whole period of time with coupons and Groupons and that. Like we did all of that because it was there. You'd have to try it. And then I just watched to see, am I getting a return on investment? Was it sufficient? Did it move the needle? Every market is different. And what worked for me in Rochester in tutoring didn't necessarily work for other tutors in other areas, didn't work for other professionals in Rochester. But then everybody had different paths to their ideal tutor. I would never say take out a billboard on the side of a highway, but for some industries, that's a perfect way to reach clients. So with a lot of experimentation, I committed a lot of money. And, what's the old saying? We're going to mangle it, but basically it's, half of your marketing dollars return, you just don't know which half. You have to keep doing that. So I'm not so worried about loss aversion anymore. I think I am more worried. There's a certain point in the growth of a business person where you have to learn to have the vision. You learn that the investment, that what you call putting money into something, spending money on something, it isn't money to fear losing. It's that you lose more by never spending it in the first place. You lose more. If you are an individual, say, who keeps crunching the numbers and says, I could never hire someone else. I could never make enough money to pay for that person. That's a vision problem, right? That's a logistical challenge that you have to overcome to say, well, wait a second, how does everybody else do it? I could never spend money on advertising. I could never build a website. Couldn't afford it. We have to learn to overcome that fear and recognize that it's often holding us back for doing the thing that, if our vision still makes sense and our model is intelligent and our value is still present, even if we extend a certain area, you just have to go there. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you have to take a balanced approach. And another problem people have is that they try something, it didn't work for them, and they won't go there again, despite right. evidence and advice from people who know maybe better, or it has worked for. That's a bad situation to be in.
So what we found in that, so in test preparation has traditionally been a very lonely profession, and we all were very siloed. If you didn't work for an organization that employed a number of tutors, there's a good chance you didn't have friendly relations or even professional relations with other test prep professionals. And it's only in the last 5 years that that's changed. And I'm thrilled to say that I've been part of the process of bringing a lot of people together through, Amy Seeley in Cleveland and I started the Test and the Rest podcast in 2019. And when we did that, we started to knit together individuals that we had met in other locations in the country. And then we created a Facebook group called Test Prep Tribe, which is an industry test prep group on Facebook. And, we have many hundreds of professionals in that group now, really generously sharing information. And so that's where a lot of us were able to get that perspective that you describe, where if I tried something once, I tried something twice, it still wasn't working for me. I suddenly had a network of individuals who in their own markets, with their own practices, they tried and they said, no, it really worked for me, but this is how I made it work. And so that's a big piece, that if you're trying something and it's not working for you, you don't know why, the best thing you could do is find somebody who can help you and say, well, this is how it worked for me. And the closer they are to what you do, the better. In that, you know, I could go to a plumber's conference and speak with a lot of plumbers. There's often small business owners as well. They serve communities, but chances are what works for that industry doesn't necessarily work for mine. But if I can speak with other educators and find out what they do and find out their CRM systems and find out how they keep the books and they keep their calendars and where they get their curriculum and how they hire, all of that, my life has suddenly become way more efficient and effective. So those communities are critical. And in fact, you know, through Tess and the Rest, Amy and I offered a lot of professional development opportunities. And we rolled that into the National Test Prep Association when a number of like-minded individuals came together and created a nonprofit organization to serve our industry. It never existed, right? So imagine all the different professions in the world and all the different professional organizations that support them and the value that they get from that. And then imagine yourself outside that. There's no lobby, you know, advocating for your rights. There are no marketing publications consolidating your wisdom. There's nothing. And we decided collectively we'd had enough of that. We'd had enough of nothing. We wanted something rich. We wanted something valuable, again, where we can confront very much what you described, that frustration of operating without clarity because we're all trying to reinvent a wheel. Why bother? Why do that when you can connect with other individuals, share what you've learned, and learn from others along the way?
Absolutely. And thank you, Mike. You've put a nice segue there for two things. One was the EFL Magazine Entrepreneur Conference on the 27th and 28th of August, where you'll have a chance to pull up a seat and get ringside with our panel of experts from social media marketing, marketing itself, podcasting, and of course, entrepreneurs. So I'll put a link in the show notes about that. And the second was, Mike, you yourself, we want to talk about other things that you do. You talked about the Test and the Rest, Test Prep Tribe. And so please elaborate a little bit on those.
So, I mean, you know, Test and the Rest, this podcast is very near and dear to my heart because it's, you know, as a podcaster, one of the best things that you could ever ask for is the ability to identify someone very interesting that you'd like to have a conversation with and then actually invite them to have a conversation and have the conversation and learn from it and then be able to share what you learned and just perpetuate that cycle of exchanging knowledge. So we loved the podcast, and we didn't really have preconceived notions of where it would take us, but it did take us to creating the kind of community that we always desired. And these days I'm exploring, like, my new passion right now with the podcast is building out a YouTube channel for it. So in the past 2 weeks, I've become a very quick, I'm not going to say an expert, but I am a beginner. I know more than I did 2 weeks ago, and I know just enough to be dangerous. So we've started to put out some clips. I've launched a new, I've been focusing very much on test preparation because this particular segment of education, and it is education, the segment of education has been threatened from a lot of misunderstandings about the value of the assessments. And we don't create the assessment. We just help students do better on them, and that's teaching. And a lot of people got it twisted and thought, well, that's not really teaching. But when we all get together, we're talking about math. We're talking about teaching math, and we're talking about teaching English, and we're talking about teaching reading and writing and time management and executive function. And that's what we all do. So I have been more and more interested in exploring other branches of this tree of tutoring. You know, what do language tutors and academic tutors and executive function coaches and test prep tutors all have in common? What are the aspects of our profession and the shared craft that we have that we can share? So just within the last month, I launched Tutor the Newsletter, and it's a free email newsletter that publishes once a week right now. And that's another venue to explore. So I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of publishing. And I have a background in that and publishing online because 19 years ago, I started accidentally what turned out to be the world's most popular birding blog. It was a time, if you could imagine, because I believe we're pretty much of the same generation, Philip. So when blogging first started and people wanted to get into that and it looked really interesting. It was back when, you know, the original diarists were getting book deals and movies. And I was looking at it from the outside and I was like, wow, this looks really interesting. I want to try it. And at the same time, my general interest in nature had become sharpened to want to know what all those different birds were that I saw flying around when I was hiking. And so I put the two together because I was an educator. And I was like, all right, if I want to learn about this, I'll force myself to write about it at the same time, because that will create a requirement that I have to advance my knowledge because I'm writing about it. And while I'm writing about it, I'm learning about this online tool. I'm going to see, this is back when there was no WordPress. I was using Microsoft Front Page, which was a horrible blogging platform. But, you know, but I learned a lot from just that, kludging together my own RSS feed or anything like that. And so it was that opportunity to join a growing movement. And I got my first taste of community building because I was a decent writer and I would write and I would just try to get what I was writing out there. And there was no place to get it out because there was no real infrastructure, but I would start to share information where I could connect with other nature bloggers. And eventually my blog started to get really popular, and then it got really popular. And then I kind of created a hub of this nature blog network. And we had thousands of nature and science blogs, and science blogging became a really big thing. And I remember speaking at the first science blogging conference in North Carolina, and the birding part started to take off. And eventually, just again, this project where I entered into it just because I wanted to learn more and share what I was learning, I started getting offered trips all over the world. First the Americas, and, you know, I'd be invited to stay at a lodge in Jamaica, or I'd be invited on a trip sponsored by a board of tourism in Guatemala for a week. And they would just take me all over the country, show me amazing birds and introduce me to fantastic people. And that became a big chunk of my hobby. You know, it was never professional for me, even though it made some money, but it never replaced education as my profession. But it was certainly an exciting way to explore an interest that I still have today of birding, nature, conservation, and travel, kind of knitting all that together.
Okay, it's interesting. I did a quick Google there on birding because I'm more familiar with the term bird watching.
Yes. In the US, you know, make it active. We're like, we're birding.
Yeah. Okay. So I was like, is this a completely different thing? But it is bird watching. Do you say twitcher?
We do say twitcher. We don't. So you have to understand that the United States birding or bird watching community is not nearly as systematized and functional as the UK. Like, you know, the heart of international bird watching is in the United Kingdom. But we do, you know, we will twitch. You know, you want to go see a bird that you have never seen before, and you're going to go a long way to see this weird bird, you're twitching. And if you miss it, you're dipping. And, you know, it's the whole model carries over.
Excellent. And tell me a little bit about your writing as well. You mentioned, or you maybe you didn't mention, I read in your bio about your book on entrepreneurship.
So, you know, it's interesting because you meet a lot of people. Have you written many books, Philip?
I have one book, English Oral Questions by EFL Magazine. It's sold about 15 copies, but I'm planning more.
Right. But that's the thing, right? So when you tell people you wrote a book, they're like, oh, that's fantastic. That must be amazing. Oh, it's awesome. People like put their lives on hold for years. Oh, I'm writing a book. I'm working on this. What I realized over time, because I do a lot of writing, as you do, is that the book itself doesn't mean a thing. This book was fantastic. I was, you know, I have a good friend who's a fantastic entrepreneur, and he had this idea that we all business people have these stories of where, you know, you learn from failure. And a bunch of us came together and we we crafted this idea of crash and learn, right? Like you crashed, but you didn't burn. You learned from the experience. And so we all contributed a chapter of our business success from failure. And it was great. And the, you know, Crash and Learn is an Amazon bestseller. Like, that's great. It didn't change my life in the slightest. It has no impact whatsoever, except it was fun to do. It was fun to share my story. And that's so I find myself looking more to ways to share ideas, whether it's in text or voice or video, that actually have more of an impact. You know, I'm a prolific blogger and I love blogging. I find that blogging is a great way to share information in intelligible pieces. And then maybe you distribute that, you syndicate it, you wrap it up in a newsletter, or you build on it and you talk about it in a podcast. But I just love that idea of trying to get these ideas out. I think I do have another book in me, but I don't know when that's going to be.
Yeah, same here. I think I have business oral questions maybe this time, and we'll have a different colored cover and just have them for business.
That's right.
And build from there. So, you mentioned the podcasting, and I think the success to podcasting is getting good guests. And Mike, you've been a fantastic guest today. And another thing I didn't do, which podcasters should do, is refer to your website often and your links, and remind the visitors who come in halfway, maybe. Or, well, I suppose, do they do that on my podcast?
Usually, they drop off halfway. Yeah. Maybe they come in halfway. Sometimes. Would you like me to share all the links? Make that easy?
Yeah, we can. We'll share in the show notes. But I think it's chariotlearning.com.
Chariotlearning.com is my educational business.
Because it's written behind you there. So that's how I know that. Yeah.
Right. The podcast is testandtherest.com is the easiest way to find it. Tutornewsletter.com, nice and easy. And nationaltestprep.org are all ways to find projects that I am a part of.
And what's for the future? For Mike, what's down the tracks?
You know, I haven't traveled internationally since the pandemic. So, you know, if we're talking non-professionally, I definitely am eager to get out of the U.S. and see the rest of this glorious world. But, you know, what's for the future? Definitely building out more. Again, the concepts that I spoke about education and community and bringing real value to those interactions. These are paths that I continue to explore for high schoolers preparing for the SAT, for teachers that want to become better tutors, licensing the Chariot Learning curriculum as a special, you know, SAT, ACT program, and doing lots of training. All those areas, those are the areas that I enjoy working the most, because I really love working with those people, those eager students, those professionals that are advancing and sharing information.
Mike, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Philip. It's been fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast with Philip Pound. For more great advice and resources, check out EFLmagazine.com. If you found this podcast helpful, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next time.